You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. Hello, everyone. I'm Allison Footer from MLB.com. And as you look at the standings in the NL West, this is kind of exactly how this thing might shake out toward the end of the season. At least the top three teams right now are the three teams that we're expecting to be in this thing come September during the stretch drive. So you have the Dodgers in first place, which is pretty amazing considering everything that they're dealing with injury-wise. Yasiel Puig is out. Kenley Jansen has been out, their closer. He is healing and expected to come back soon. But, of course, they've had some great performances from players like Andre Ethier and Jock Peterson. And, of course, when you have the top of the rotation as they do, then nothing is really that bad. So the San Diego Padres giving up a lot of home runs, like an alarming rate. So they have given up 50 as of this taping, and that is the most in the major league. So they're trying to figure that out. And the San Francisco Giants are had a terrible start to the season, but are climbing out of that, are right around the 500 mark, and they've had some great performances by people that you wouldn't have expected when the season started, like Chris Heston, Matt Duffy, stepping up and helping out the offense, helping out the rotation, so that's been encouraging. And then the Diamondbacks and the Rockies are kind of at the bottom of the division and struggling in different ways, but actually, they're kind of similar in that their pitching is struggling and their bullpen is taxed. And, of course, when you have that, it becomes a very long season. So they're trying to work through those issues. And, as always, the NL West is a very interesting place to be.
And, Ken, a lot of talk, a lot of attention lately on Jock Peterson. Our colleague Lyle Spencer had a really nice column about him on MLB.com just about, you know, some comparisons that he doesn't really want at this point. Being compared to some of the greats in the game, and I think that Jock understands it's a little too early to be putting him in those categories. But at the same time, what he's doing right now has to be just a welcome sight for everyone in the Dodgers organization.
Well, yeah, and you know, a lot of the attention is on the offense, but I think if you talk to players who are playing alongside of him, I think the defense that he's provided in center field has been a big upgrade and has really been appreciated by the pitchers. He's saved a lot of runs. He covers a lot of ground. He pretty much gets good routes to balls. And he's really kind of helped to solidify at the middle, along with Rollins at short and Kendrick at second base, a defense that, while the Dodgers are scoring a lot of runs, and that's a big part of why they're winning, they're also preventing a lot of runs, and that's also a big part of why they're winning, and Jock Peterson is right in the middle of that.
So we're taping this conversation the day after Giancarlo Stanton hit a home run out of Dodger Stadium, only the fifth home run ever to leave Dodger Stadium in the stadium's history. So it traveled 475 feet, according to MLB.com StatCast. What were your thoughts when you watched it? Did it just, his home runs tend to leave the yard very quickly. What were some of your thoughts as you were watching this home run?
Well, I noticed that the pitcher who threw the ball was kind of smiling as he watched it, sail out of the stadium. So I think, even he got kind of a kick out of how awesome it was. And, that's not new. Stanton's been doing this for a while, though he hasn't done it at Dodger Stadium until last night. But, I remember seeing Dave Kingman hit monster shots and Piazza hit him out and Stargell and I think Holiday and maybe Mark McGwire. I think that's the whole list in 50-something years. So it doesn't happen often. It's quite a sight. But of course, it only counts for one run. The Dodgers scored 11, so right. it was a monstrous losing effort, really.
Correct. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier, I'm sure, for the Dodgers to swallow that, considering it's the only run that was scored. Interestingly, it's only the third longest home run that's been hit this year. So Nelson Cruz and Josh Donaldson both have longer home runs. But anyway. Let's move on to Andre Ethier, who is a fascinating study. So he, we've talked about many times throughout spring training, that he was kind of the unhappy guy that had lost his starting job, still on the team, not traded and sort of had to accept that role. Well, now he's playing a lot because Yasiel Puig has been injured and out of the lineup. And Ethier is really taking advantage of this time and was 5-for-5 in yesterday's game with the home run. And so I guess it's good to see him being able to contribute, and he seems to have a pretty good attitude toward this whole thing.
He really has, and he worked hard during the off season. He had a good spring training. The big thing he says is he's healthy, and really for the last 3 or 4 years he says he hasn't been, and it's not an empty statement. I think everybody knows that he had been playing nicked up. The guy plays hurt, but it also affects his performance. And Puig arrived on the scene and was a sensation. They had too many outfielders when Kemp came back from his injuries. Somebody had to go, and Kemp went. I'm sure Dodger management would have preferred to trade Ethier, but Kemp brought more in return. So they kept Ethier to be an extra outfielder. That was really the plan, you know. And the plan wasn't for Puig to go down for a month, but he has. And in that time, Ethier is playing similar to the way he was when he was an All-Star and a Silver Slugger and a Gold Glove. He's a little older now, and maybe he doesn't run quite as fast, but. He's showing a lot of those tools that he showed back in what was believed to be his prime. And the timing is great because the Dodgers need it. Not only is Puig out of the lineup with Carl Crawford, so they've lost two of their starting three outfielders, and Ethier has stepped up, and he's hitting over 300. He's already got more home runs than he had last year. And, you know, it's a win-win story all the way around for the team and for him.
And let's touch on Puig a little bit. He had his rehab has actually been halted. He had another setback. So can you just give us a little update on what is going on with him?
That's the update. He had a setback, and his rehab's on hold. And they don't have a timetable, although just from past performances, I'm guessing it's going to be a couple weeks because, this thing's been bothering him now for a month. So they have to shut him down, and they have to go bring him back slowly because they've already seen that this past time he came back too fast. And it's not a full tear, but he has strained it and it hasn't healed. So I'm guessing it's going to be 2 to 3 weeks before he's back in the lineup.
Yeah, those are things you can't come back from too quickly, or else it just ends up extending the amount of time they're out anyway. But some good news on Kenley Jansen. So he seems to be close, and that'll help a lot with the bullpen situation. And I say that realizing that the Dodgers are in first place and have so far been very good at piecing things together despite how depleted some of the areas of the roster are. But Jansen, I guess, may be activated this weekend?
Right, that's the plan. He'll throw again tonight and then be activated probably Saturday. And you are talking about a team that hasn't had its closer all season, lost 40% of its starting rotation, lost two-thirds of its starting outfield. They've had a lot of injuries, and they've won anyway, which I guess really is a credit to the depth that new management has created. And they've been able to shuttle guys in and out in the bullpen and in the rotation. Even in and out of the lineup, they're getting production from Alex Guerrero, who's kind of forced his way into the third base rotation, and in left field with Crawford out. They're getting it from everywhere. Rookie relievers, they've got three rookie relievers who have all pitched well. So, they've got depth that they haven't had in the past. They've been able to fill in for these injured players, and they just keep on winning, and they're almost unbeatable at home. So it's been a pretty good combination.
Yeah, looking at the standings, it's not shocking what's going on with the Dodgers and the Giants, the Padres taking this first three spots, kind of what we thought might be happening in September also. So, Ken, thanks very much, and we will speak with you next week.
Okay, thanks, Allison.
And I am here to talk about the Homer Happy Padres with Corey Brock. Homer Happy being that the Padres are not happy because they were the ones allowing the home runs. So, Corey, I feel like a broken record. I realize that this is what we say every week. The Padres have always had very strong pitching, and that was not going to be the issue, and everything was going to be great. And, my goodness, they're allowing a lot of home runs, and it sounds like Buddy Black is not real happy about this. What's going on?
Yeah, I thought this was supposed to be the Padres' new offense hitting all these home runs, Allison. I guess they got the blueprint kind of mixed up. But, yeah, it's been a rough start for these guys. You know, their pitchers have pitched, you know, especially the starters have pitched pretty well for the most part. But as a staff, though, starters and relievers have given up an alarming amount of home runs. Gave up 6 against the Mariners in the first game of their series in Seattle. And that put them on top of the league lead, first place that you don't want to have with the most home runs allowed in baseball. And, you know, I think there's probably a few factors here in place. And, but most of it sort of rests on the shoulder of the pitching staff in terms of not executing pitches, too many pitches elevated, falling into some bad counts. A lot of things sort of contribute to this. The good news is, though, that, you know, they feel like they have the right guys. You know, they have the right guys in the rotation, the right guys in the bullpen, and that they're just kind of weathering a tough storm right now, and that things will even out eventually because these guys, you know, past performances have shown that, you know, these guys have pretty good stuff. You know, they do lead the big leagues in strikeouts as a staff. They got a lot of swing and miss guys. The bullpen has traditionally been pretty good. It's been rough so far, but you know, I just think they're kind of going through a tough stretch right now. And, you know, I'm sure that's something pitching coach Darren Balsley and Buddy Black, the manager, are going to, you know, have some talks with and try and get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, it is just kind of a head-scratcher for many reasons. One just being I realize that that Petco Park does play a lot more fair than it has in the past. They've made some adjustments. But it's still not, a terribly easy place to hit a home run. And when you say that they lead the league in home runs allowed, we have to put the numbers to it. As of this taping, they've allowed 50 home runs, the most in the majors, just one ahead of the Milwaukee Brewers, which is that's just something you don't want to have happen if you're a team that's not the Brewers. And starting pitchers have allowed 34. The relief pitchers have allowed 16. That being halfway to the entire total that the relief pitchers gave up in 2014. So, yeah, things are going to even out. Going to have to start pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, again, with the you mentioned the Brewers there, and, you know, certainly a team that's had all sorts of problems and don't, you know, appear to be heading in the wrong direction there, whereas, you know, they're probably trying to figure out some answers with their pitching staff if they have the right guys. And like I said, the Padres feel like they have the right guys. You know, you're talking about James Shields, Andrew Cashner, and Tyson Ross at the top of that rotation. Certainly maybe not the best staff in the National League in terms of top three guys, but right up there. And, you know, guys who have missed a lot of bats in the past and track records that show that they've been very successful pitchers. You know, you just have to think that things will normalize here at some point. But that being said, in order to do so, they have to pitch better. You know, you can't elevate as many balls in the strike zone because hitters will take advantage of that. You got to get ahead of guys. You know, strike one, that's always the most important pitch. You know, it's pitching coaches will tell you, you know, getting ahead of guys and then working from there and being able to use some more pitches and maybe expand the strike zone on some of these hitters instead of having them just, you know, sitting and waiting for, you know, 2-0 fastballs or 3-1 fastballs.
Now, Andrew Cashner has been, I guess we can call him the hard luck loser. We don't want to say loser, just want a loser, but he's not had a lot of wins. And, of course, all of the modern age people that are occupying these front offices, they don't care about wins and losses when it comes to pitchers. But at the same time, it is pretty amazing that he's not won more games, given he's got a pretty good ERA.
Yeah, he's pitched well. I'd like to consider him to be the best six-loss pitcher in the universe, Allison. He been a victim of poor run support and really a victim of poor defense and starts that he's made. It's kind of alarming that he's allowed 10 unearned runs so far this year. This is a guy that's made fewer than, you know, I don't know where he's at, about seven or eight starts. That's a lot of unearned runs. So the Padres' defense, not real crisp behind him. But, you know, by and large, you know, he's kept the team in games. Yeah, the earned run average is good, which is a number we should be looking at here. You know, strikeouts, innings pitched. He's done a much better job since that first start in L.A. in April. We gave up 3 home runs to Adrian Gonzalez. So I've done a better job with his slider and keeping the ball in the ballpark. So, yeah, it's those six losses don't look very good, but it's by no means an indication of how well he's pitched.
You know, I say that that front offices and the analysts and people that are paying attention, that they don't care about wins and losses. I think I've talked to you about this before, but let's talk about it again. Do pitchers care about wins and losses? I mean, is it still something on them? Does it, you know, in just in your observations, your opinion, should they care if they're 2-6 or 1-6 or 7-3? Does that take any kind of mental toll on these guys when they don't have the wins?
You know, I suppose if it kind of keeps happening time after time, it could kind of weigh on you a little bit as a pitcher. But I think, you know, if it does bother them, they would never say it. And, you know, the guys would never, you know, in terms of, you know, we've had this a lot in the past with the Padres before they, you know, beefed up their offense where, you know, a lot of pitchers throwing very well and not getting any run support. And they never pin it on the offense. You know, they always kind of say, hey, this is something I could have done better. When in fact, you know that if the team had scored two runs for the guy, the results would have been vastly different. But, you know, if it bothers them, they keep it inside. I think ultimately the only win-loss record that matters to all of these guys is whether the team wins or loses the game and not whether they're the pitcher of record one way or the other. I think it's just, you know, doing their job, limiting the opponents, limiting the damage, and just sort of, you know, they always say it, and it's kind of a cliche, but I think it's really true, just kind of doing their part to put their team in position to win. And I think if they do that, then they could walk away from a start, you know, feeling pretty good that they've done their job. They've done everything within their power to accomplish that. So I think these guys are pretty pragmatic, and they're proud guys too. You know, they, you know, I'm sure they don't like seeing those losses pile up, but I think they understand there's sort of a greater good at stake here. And a lot of them are really good about that.
Yeah. Well, my prediction before the season started was that Matt Kemp was going to have a monster year, having been traded to a team in his division and a team in the division that he played in with the Dodgers, of course, and then that he was going to have this little chip on his shoulder and that he was just going to go off with a vengeance. It hasn't quite happened yet. He's got respectable numbers, but, you know, the power doesn't seem to be coming. So he's only has one home run. What do you think of Matt Kemp? And, you know, just like in the short term, maybe in the long term, you know, how is he fitting into the team?
Yeah, you know, I think he's fitting in really well. And I know they impressed upon him in spring training to be a leader with this group. And he sort of embraced that role and was very good in the clubhouse and still is, I think, you know, and, you know, had a very good April. If you look at the numbers other than the home runs, in terms of batting average, on base percentage, and driving in runs, you know, there's some doubles in there. I think he did a pretty good job in terms of doing everything that they wanted him to do, other than, you know, maybe you would expect a little bit more power. I still think we're going to see some more of that as we work a little bit deeper into the season. You know, certainly playing a lot of games at some of these big ballparks probably doesn't help a whole lot. I mean, it hasn't hurt Justin Upton by any means, but I think he's kind of a different beast at this point. But I think, you know, Kemp's been pretty good. You know, he played a lot of games, Allison, in April, and they gave him a break here last week, and he was scuffling a little bit at the plate, and, you know, maybe just a little bit of fatigue had set in there. They gave him Sunday off against the Diamondbacks, and then the team had Monday off. So, you know, just like anything else, you know, they probably have to be a little bit mindful of when he gets some rest. But here's the other thing. The guy wants to play every day. And, you know, I really get the sense from Buddy Black that if he's not in that lineup, he's probably knocking on that manager's door asking why. You know, and he doesn't back off against these perceived stud pitchers, these ace pitchers. He wants to be in there every day. So I think that's a good sign. And, you know, I still think there's a very good ball player in there. And we've certainly seen a lot of glimpses of that. So, you know, I have to think he's going to be better moving forward into the season.
And let's end this on just kind of going over maybe some injury issues. So Will Myers seems to be, I guess, day-to-day with the sore left wrist. That could be a little bit detrimental if they're looking for some offense just because he is leading the team with hits and runs scored at this point. So what is the update on him?
Yeah, he I wouldn't say it's an injury, but maybe kind of tweaked the wrist Sunday in Arizona when he was sliding, kind of used the left hand to plant on the ground, I guess. And he was hoping with the off day on Monday that it would kind of go away. He went through batting practice yesterday, and it was still bothering him. So he kind of, you know, smartly kind of pulled himself out of that batting practice round, and they scratched him. But, you know, we talked to him after the game, and he was moving the wrist around. He said it really only bothers him on the, you know, he's a right-handed hitter on his backswing, you know, and the follow-through on his swing. So he didn't seem too alarmed by it. You know, that's a guy that's had wrist issues in the past. He had the fractured right wrist last season, but he also jammed his left wrist early in the year. You know, that took some, took a little while to heal. This doesn't seem nearly as serious as that. We'll get more of an update later, but yeah, this is a guy you don't want out of the lineup for a lot of reasons. I mean, he's been a real bright spot at the top of the order, and you know, in terms of getting on base, even driving in runs, scoring a lot of runs. Certainly, with the guys behind him doing a very good job. But he's been good. You know, he's been playing a lot of first base with Yonder Alonso out, and this is certainly a very important piece to the puzzle. Moving forward, and you know, the wrists are sort of a delicate thing, but I truly didn't get the sense from him that this was going to be anything that would linger too long.
Well, that is good news. Okay, well, thanks, Corey, very much, and we'll speak with you next week.
Sounds good, Allison. Thank you.
Steve, I'm trying to figure out your team. So, you know, a couple games under 500. They've had some good stretches and some not so good stretches, but. Josh Kallmentzer seems to be struggling a little bit, and there's some residual effects from that, and that the bullpen is kind of getting stretched at the same time. So let's start just by talking about him a little bit. I mean, he was one of the sort of constants in the rotation when the season started, but he's really kind of fallen on some hard times.
Yeah, you know, he had a hard time his last time out. Just didn't seem to be able to command his fastball, didn't seem to be able to keep it down, and with a guy like him who doesn't have overpowering stuff or light up a radar gun, you really need to locate the fastball. That's crucially important for him. He wasn't able to do that, and so he ended up leaving with just, I believe it was one out the second inning. So it did tax the bullpen, but, you know, thankfully for them, they had Vidal Nuño, who they had called up earlier in the day from AAA Reno, and he was able to go another 6 2/3, so that really saved the bullpen that day and you know, set them up for the rest of the series. But the clutch performance by Nuño really kind of bailed out the Diamondbacks in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, part of the job of the coaching staff and the manager's job is really to be looking seven steps ahead of everybody else. And so you do, I mean, depth is so important, but you do kind of have to mentally sort of figure out what's coming up, not so much just what's going to be happening that day, but what could happen the next few days. Like, that can get to be a pretty tough task when you have a sort of a mediocre team where, you know, there's not a ton of depth right now.
Right. I think one of the biggest challenges for them has been managing the 40-man roster, managing, you know, who's coming up, who's going down, as they try to, you know, with some of the starters going short early in the season, it taxed the bullpen. Then they had the double headers after back-to-back rainouts in Denver. So they had to make some adjustments, and that always necessitates some up and downs, and you know, which guys have options, and how you can get innings, and who's on the 40 and who's not on the 40, and how can you get them on the 40 if they're not on the 40. So yeah, they've done a lot of juggling, a lot of mixing and matching to kind of stay right around the 500 mark this year.
So some good news that Archie Bradley seems to be ready to come back. So he had a four-inning simulated game, and he says that he's ready to start on Saturday versus the Phillies. So, first of all, I mean, he said it, but is the team saying that too?
Yeah, the team is planning on having him go Saturday against the Phillies in Philadelphia. He's been it's really remarkable. I mean, he got hit in the face with a line drive traveling 115 miles an hour, and his mental toughness has so far been amazing. Now the real test will be when he gets back up on the mound in a major league game as opposed to a simulated game. And, you know, does he flinch? Is he, you know, still able to perform and focus on what he has to focus on? But so far in the simulated game, he threw the other day, Cliff Pennington hit a line drive right back up the middle on him. And, you know, Archie apparently did not flinch. Cliff Pennington, though, flinched a little bit. He turned to Dave Stewart, who was standing behind the cage, and said, "Am I cut now? Am I being released?" So, you know, that was actually a good test, though, for Bradley to kind of get that out of the way a little bit. But we'll see what happens once if it happens in a major league game.
Yeah, I've always found it kind of fascinating, this side of it, because there's no way to measure mental toughness or what happens to a guy after something like this happens. Of course, there's absolutely no stats for that, and there's no way to even have a conversation, because you're not going to have a frank conversation with anybody about if they do have any issues. You think about, like, Dickie Thon when he got hit in the face, and, like, he was never the same again. And there's just, here from time to time, you see guys sort of decline a little bit, and so it's just interesting. I mean, but, like, Archie Bradley, you know him, the kind of guy he is. I guess that he would be able to overcome something like this and maybe not have it. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is it would be a natural thing, like every time the ball is hit, to kind of flinch. Just wonder if the same thing is going to happen. It's a hard thing to put it out of your mind what happened.
Yeah, I think one of the things that helps him, and he and I were talking about this the other day, is the fact that, he was a really highly regarded high school quarterback. In fact, had a turned down a scholarship offer to be the quarterback at Oklahoma University to sign with the Diamondbacks. And, he was saying, hey, I've been hit harder by linemen when I got sacked. You get hit right up under the chin, and, you have to get right back out there, and you can't be afraid then to roll out. You can't be afraid to stand in the pocket. So I guess in a certain sense, maybe he has the mental toughness from football, or at least he has some experience with that in terms of, getting right back up and after it.
Yeah, and these professional athletes, they tend to be fearless in ways that we can never even understand. We couldn't possibly put it into any part of our lives, like exactly how things do not. Because, if you think about it, just a guy hitting the ball, he's got a 95 mile an hour ball coming at him. Even if it goes over the plate, it's still 6 inches from him. I don't know that I could ever do that. So it's just second nature for these guys to constantly be faced with those kinds of situations.
Yeah, it really is. And it's incredible when you think about it that these guys stand in there and face the kind of risks that they face. And we see it all the time, too, now with pitchers, with the line drives back up the middle. And, they keep doing it. And there is something that is just you have to have a certain mental toughness to play sports, especially baseball, with all the failure that goes on. Even the most successful hitters, they always say fail 7 out of 10 times. There's a lot of mental toughness that goes into being able to bounce back from an 0-for-4 game with 4 strikeouts and come back the next day, day game after night game, and pretend like that the day before never happened.
Yeah, I was watching Giancarlo Stanton last night. He just seems to have no issues with that face mask on, bouncing back and having a monster year so far. Anyway, let's move on to the draft, because, of course, the Arizona Diamondbacks are going to have the number one pick. It's a very odd thing for me to be talking about another team besides the Houston Astros having that number one pick. So it's one of those dubious honors that you get when you had the worst season the year before, so it's not something that really teams want. But at the same time, it's kind of nice not have to worry about who's picking before you in that first round. So it's still a little bit early. I mean, we're a couple weeks away, but are they going to go for the best player available, which is normally the way it goes? Are they looking for any kind of, is there a dearth of any positions in the system? Where do you see this headed?
Well, it seems to be the general consensus around baseball, and also when you talk to people in the organization, that this particular draft, while it has plenty of quality players, doesn't really have like one or two headliners like you've seen in previous years, whether that's Bryce Harper or Strasburg or somebody that's kind of like a no-brainer number one pick, kind of star quality there. So I think that actually opens up a lot of options for the Diamondbacks. They can either take who they believe is the absolute best player at number one. They can work to try to cut a pre-draft deal for a little bit under slot with somebody who they believe is comparable to, because if they're all almost equal talent-wise, if you can get a guy at a little less cost, then you can redistribute that money later in the draft and maybe take somebody with an even higher upside that would be more difficult to sign. So as of right now, they're still out there scouting, and they haven't really convened yet to start putting their board together. But it's going to be fascinating to see what they do, because, if there was a no-brainer number one pick or somebody or three people that had really separated themselves from the pack, that would be one thing. But this year it seems to be kind of everybody's kind of almost on the same level, at least at the top of the draft. So that makes for a lot more interesting choices.
I can't imagine what it's like to be able to make all the numbers work, and you have to do it in such a small amount of time. I mean, I had a little exposure to it when I was working for the Astros, and I was in their draft room, just when they had one of their number one picks. And it's just to be able to realign, you know, to go a little bit under slot and to realign to other guys, but you have to also be positive that those guys are going to sign. And it's all like within like 25 minutes that you really can come down and like know exactly what you're going to do. That has to be so stressful.
Yeah, and the good thing for the Diamondbacks in this case is, you know, having that number one pick, you know, no one's going to take it. They know that whoever they decide to take, they can have him. Whereas if you're working with, you know, 2, 3, 4, whatever it might be after that, you know, it's so dependent on what the teams in front of you do. So they'll have a little bit extra time to kind of plan for that number one pick, but there are a lot of decisions that get made on the fly, and there's a lot of stressful moments that can happen in those draft rooms as a result.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I wish they would just let cameras in there to get, you know. I mean, we'll never see exactly what happens because there's a lot of, like, crazy stuff that happens with, like, 10 minutes left that teams would never, ever want anybody to know, but it is cool to see it happen. Anyway, Steve, thanks so much, and we will talk to you next week. I don't know. I was laughing. I haven't talked to you about Troy Tulowitzki to the Mets in a good 2 months, maybe three. Boom, it's right back in the papers. So I think the most important part about this whole thing is basically that Tulowitzki is supposedly meeting with his agent this week, possibly to devise a plan to ask for a trade. Of course, Tulowitzki is saying that he has no idea what anyone's talking about and that he talks to his agent all the time. So what do you make of all of this?
Well, I think the Rockies, first of all, today are mired in a 10-game losing streak, and it's a tough West Coast road trip against the Angels and the Dodgers. And it's very hard, if you're him, to see the way out of this because the struggles with pitching and, frankly, the offense hasn't performed. It just seems that all of the dreams of everything coming together with a good lineup and possibly the pitching staff developing, it looks so far away right now. And the questions are going to start, and they've already started, obviously. So if you look at it, when the agent is discussing this with the New York media, Joel Sherman of the New York Post had an excellent story with quotes from Troy Tulowitzki's agent, Paul Cohen, then you can see that there is a look at least toward the exit, even if he hasn't said, yes, I've asked the Rockies for a trade, and as far as we know, hasn't gone to them and said, trade me now. You can see where this thing could be heading and probably is heading.
And that's understandable, but it's unfortunate because it's going to be very complicated. It's not like Tulowitzki is a low-salary guy who's early in his career. He's got a lot of money coming to him. And so it's a matter of, you know, these things are so hard because it's a matter of finding a match, another team to be a trade partner, somebody who wants to take on that salary, who has the players that the Rockies would want to make a trade. And it's just, you know, the Mets obviously make the most sense because the Mets need him, and they have pitching depth that they might be able to, work something out with the Rockies. But this is not something that can happen. It's easier to do this stuff in the offseason. It could potentially be a big distraction while the team's trying to play baseball.
Well, you know, I do think these are easier to do in the off season. However, a lot of times in off season, there's so much time that you can really talk yourself out of these things, and that's why sometimes it doesn't happen in the off season. I mean, if you look at it, the Rockies changed general managers, and you know the new general manager and Tulowitzki. And Tulowitzki's commented on this. The general manager kept him abreast of all that was going on, not only with trade rumors, but what the plans were for the team. And at that point, you know, Tulowitzki did not ask for a trade at that point. You know, he was like, hey, this could work out. But now with the season, with you in the season and with the Mets looking like a contender in need of a shortstop, then maybe that could happen. I mean, I think there are other teams that could swoop into here. There are always those surprise teams. You know, I know that last year there were discussions with the Mets, or at least were plans on the part of both teams, the Mets and the Rockies, to see what would happen if the magic phone call came. It never did come. But also, the Cardinals were in on it, where, you know, where the Rockies and Cardinals studied one another. I'm sure there are other teams. I think there could be a surprise team or two to sneak into this thing. So if he does ask for a trade, or if the Rockies are entertaining a trade, or if they just come to the conclusion that if you have pitching, then we have a shortstop, then a lot of things can happen.
Yeah, and they need pitching. Jeff Breidich has had some interesting comments lately, and you know, he says that this is a good group of players that's way underperforming. I'm paraphrasing here. So I don't know. I get a little bit trapped maybe when I hear general managers talk about things like that, because the fact that there's no pitching depth is only one person's fault, and that would be Jeff Breidich. And I understand where they are in their organization and where they're headed, what they're trying to build, but the same thing, like they've left themselves completely vulnerable to really be in danger of having no discernible way to get through nine innings every day, six times a week. So, but he also said hitters aren't driving in runs, and it's very nearly a complete team failure and an issue at this point. The word failure just kind of like screams at me. But so that's basically, you know, an indictment on the lineup. Interestingly enough, the team batting average is .274, but they're the fourth lowest in runs scored, which basically means the middle of the order is not doing its job. Is that safe to say?
They have people on base all the time throughout the order, and the job isn't getting done. Tulowitzki, as well as he's hit, he's not hit for power. Carlos Gonzalez is in one of the worst slumps I've ever seen him in. And frankly, it's not an injury or anything else. It's just that he's kind of just lost his timing, and it's taking this time to get it back. He's got a stroke that takes a lot. There are a lot of moving parts in it. But you look throughout the lineup, they've tried a number of hit and runs, and for the most part, they've been miserable failures and losing guys on the bases. So offensively, there's a lot going wrong, and it's hard to explain, to be honest with you, because the talent is there to do more offensively. So, and I agree with Breidich that the offense is every bit the problem that the pitching is. Now, but when we came to this year, getting back to your point, we were saying that there wasn't a whole lot of depth or experience in the starting pitching. They don't have the front-end guy because they don't really sign that type of guy. So this was possible all along. It's not exactly a shock that they're not pitching very well. If you look at some of the things that Brady said, the hit batters and the walks, there's no reason why you're walking that many people and hitting batters. And I think what they thought was, if these guys just stayed in the strike zone and got ground balls, the defense would take care of them. So they're not staying in the strike zone, but there's always that question. If you're not pitching well, and you knew going in that you weren't pitching well, shouldn't you get better pitchers? And I think this is where it's all leading to a possible trade here.
Yeah, and another part of just being the Colorado Rockies, I mean, the realities of being this organization is that they are going to have to develop their own pitchers because, as we've talked about before, understandably, it's hard to get pitchers to come and pitch for the Rockies. Has to be a little bit alarming that Tyler Matzek has already been sent down. I know we talked about him a lot. He's a young up-and-comer, so that had to probably been a little jarring for them to have to make that decision.
Yeah, it was a little bit jarring, but if you go back to before they popped a little bit in the late 2000s, they had guys like Aaron Cook and Ubaldo Jimenez and Jeff Francis coming through. I think Jeff Francis was able to come up and stay up. The other guys, they had those ups and downs at the start of their career because not only are you adjusting to pitching in the major leagues, but you're also pitching at altitude against the best hitters. It's like you're pitching at altitude in the PCL. So that entrance into the major leagues is a little bit more difficult, and the more difficulty you have, the better the chance of injury. Right now, the Rockies, there is some depth in the organization, but not quite enough. What you need to have are a bunch of pitchers that are almost major league ready, where if one fails, you can grab a guy that you know is major league ready. They're not quite there yet, and I think that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing out of them right now, that they're having to suffer a little bit more with guys simply because they don't really have the guys to replace them.
I guess kind of with this offensive situation that's going on, if you're saying like a lot of hit and runs that aren't working, a lot of just, you know, bad things happening on the base paths, I don't know. Maybe it's one of those things where baseball is about the law of averages and things do even out, and what's not working for them now might be working for them for a longer stretch of time later on in the season, because the lineup seems to be too good to have this be happening the entire year.
Yeah, I would agree with that, although it seems that teams want to, I'm not going to say press the panic button, but they want to make a move quicker. From my talk with Breidich the other day, he did say about Gonzalez and Tulowitzki, it's early May, and we'll deal with those things when we get there. There's still the belief that this thing is going to turn around with this team. I think that one of the problems, and they're going to have to settle this within, is this. They haven't won in so long that it's hard to have confidence when you don't have results. But that's what baseball is all about. You know, you slump, then you have to believe you're going to get out of it. Even when you're in the midst of that slump, you have to have confidence without results. Right now, the Rockies fans don't have a lot of confidence because they've seen a lot of bad records over the years. And you have to ask, and the players have to ask themselves, are we good enough to get out of this? I mean, yeah, they could look at the back of the baseball cards and the batting averages and everything else and say, I'm a good player. Are we good enough as a team to get out of this? If they are going to get out of this, it would make sense to do it with Tulowitzki, because when you trade for guys, you don't know what you're going to get. But let's face it, you know, he's a guy who's 30 years old and probably looking at his career saying, do I have a chance to win? Or should I push it now to where I know I have a chance to win?
Yeah, and I mean, really, if he makes the move and they publicly ask for a trade, it's kind of game on. I mean, at that point, you almost have to. I mean, you don't have to, but that blows up instantly. There's no way to temper that whatsoever. When your star player asks for a trade, it's like that's it.
Well, what's weird though is he doesn't have a no trade clause. And usually, when you have a no trade clause, it's almost like you have a trade clause where you can engineer where you end up going.
Right.
He doesn't have any of that written into his contract. The problem when the star player asks for a trade is the other teams that are dealing with them are like, hey, this guy doesn't want to be there. We'll send you this instead of what you asked for. The Rockies tend in their trades to not make the move until they get what they really want. So what's going to happen, I know a lot of people are pointing to the Mets as the possible team. I would think there are going to have to be more teams that are kind of competing in this trade, in the trade sweepstakes, to where the Rockies can feel good about what they get when they do make this move with Tulowitzki.
Well, it is interesting, and it is got some soap opera drama, so we will keep our eyes peeled. Thomas, thank you so much, and we will check back in with you next week.
I am here for my weekly chat in person, live and in person from Houston, Texas. This is so exciting. Thank God for interleague play with Chris Haft. So, yes, the Giants, as we're recording this, are in town to play a two-game series with the Astros. And so it is old school day here in Houston. So, Chris, I feel like I just saw you guys in San Francisco and now you're here. So I feel like I'm very well-versed on your team. But let's talk about Chris Heston. So he shut down the Astros 10 strikeouts, a complete game, and just pitched beautifully. And we keep talking about him because he is obviously a guy that has stepped up huge for a pitching rotation that really needs his help.
Oh, absolutely, Allison. You know, I was riding up the elevator just a little while ago with a former Major League player. I'll just leave him nameless. And he was a former Astros Major League player. And he was saying that, you know, he observed that Heston rarely threw a strike. But I don't think he meant that out of any bitterness or anything like that. It was just, you know, his stuff was moving all over the place. And so, you know, they sure looked like strikes to the hitters, but once they crossed the plate, they weren't. But that's part of the art of pitching. And, you know, Heston sure seems like he's mastered it. One thing that's distinctive about him that isn't shared by a whole lot of pitchers, you know, today, he's thrown a lot of innings in the minor leagues. Off the top of my head, I want to say 500, maybe a little bit less, but or fewer or more. But
wow.
You know, he's really steeped in experience, and you know, so the call up I think is timely for him.
So this wasn't, I mean, his performance, this is not, of course, what's a pitching coach going to say? I can't believe what he's doing. But, I mean, maybe he's exceeded things a little bit more than they were expecting.
Oh, I think so. I mean, they designated him for assignment, if you can believe that, 2 or 3 years ago. Anybody could have had him, right? That's ridiculous. But nobody, he elected to come back to the Giants, or Giants were lucky enough to re-sign him. And, he came into camp a few years ago, as this hotshot prospect. And he did okay, not great, and went back to AAA. I think there were some injury problems also. So he's had kind of a complicated recent past. But he sure seems like he's got things squared away now.
That is interesting. And, of course, a couple games don't make the man. But Matt Duffy certainly has had a nice showing there at third base. And it happens that Casey McGee is not having such a great time there. So, of course, everyone, brings up the Wally Pipp thing, because that's just what we do in baseball. But Bruce Bochy is not really deeming Matt Duffy as the new third baseman, right? So he's kind of taking this one day at a time?
Not yet. Yeah, he's going to try to get Matt in there as often as possible. As we speak here, he's filling in for Joe Panik at second base. Mm-hmm. Matt's been kind of designated the quote-unquote super utility player, a role that was previously handled by Joaquin Arias. But Matt's just pretty much ran away with that now. And as far as third base goes, yeah, I think Casey McGee's better start hitting pretty soon, or else Bruce and I think the rest of the coaching staff want to believe in him. He's a veteran. He's proven. He's talking about Casey now. He hit 280-something last year, 286, 287, with 76, 79 RBI, which, actually matches or exceeds by a little bit what Pablo Sandoval did last year for them. I don't know if Casey – I really think this is a classic case of a guy, even though Casey's a veteran, a guy who's putting too much pressure on himself. That, or there's something physically wrong with him, which doesn't seem obvious, but it may just be a little thing like he's not seeing pitches well enough. I'm no hitting coach. So mm-hmm. I don't mean to sound like one, but that's my little dime store diagnosis, that maybe he's just not seeing the ball well enough. But it's for his own good, it's repeating too much, and so he's going to have to pick it up pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, because we're like a couple days away from it officially not being early anymore, from what I read on the internet, and the internet doesn't lie. And I think someone said it on Twitter, so that's definitely true, that May 15th is the cutoff, and then it's no longer early. And the Giants are a team that kind of are used to getting results, and there's not a lot of room for patience. So it's really comes to down to eventually it's the guy that's going to be driving in the runs and hitting the ball.
Yeah, and Matt Duffy happens to be tied for second on the team in RBI the guy's he's played what, part time, so two thirds of the time, if that. So it's really impressive. He's kind of a cerebral guy. He's 24, 25, but he's cerebral without being cerebral, in that he knows he's given hitting a lot of thought. He gives hitting a lot of thought, and he realizes with all that thinking that he shouldn't think too much. What he thinks about is his confidence. He has said repeatedly that he doesn't have his tools aren't that of a lot of other players. He is kind of slender. He is, some people call him scrawny. I don't know if he's that skinny, but he's not the most physically imposing guy. He's no John Carlos Stanton, but because he has this supreme confidence that he's not going to get beat, it really makes a difference in the swings he takes.
I don't think it's possible to be scrawny at the major league level. You can be very lanky, but I don't know if scrawny.
How about lean? Let's go with lean.
Lean and mean. So I love this story. So Monty Irvin, Hall of Famer, who lives in Houston. So the Giants, the brass, flew here with the team to give him a World Series ring. So can you tell us the origin of why he's getting one and what that was
like? Sure. They've given World Series rings to all their Hall of Famers since they went on this World Series roll, began this roll in 2010. I think all baseball organizations believe in their tradition and cherish it. Maybe there are some that do that more than others, and I think the Giants are one of them. They really honor their past. As I say, cherish the tradition. They believe that even though these guys didn't win a whole lot of championships, you know, 1954, and that was it, really. And that was when the franchise was in New York. They believe that the Willie Mays's, the Willie McCoveys, the Juan Marichals, Gaylord Perrys, people like that, set the tone, laid the groundwork. You fill in whatever cliche or phrase you want to use. They plant the seeds for these guys today, just with the integrity of their performance and the integrity they displayed also off the field. So and Monty Irvin really personifies that. He was. I'm not old enough to have seen him play, but he was just a real dignified guy. It took Willie Mays under his wing early on in Willie's career, at the outset of Willie's career. Always a positive influence. You know, stayed in baseball after he was done playing, and again was an example to people. And so they. Here he is, 96 years old. I should say 96 years young.
Wow.
He had great. I was lucky enough to tag along on this little venture. It was just great listening to him, and I'll admit I came close to getting a little choked up when he said I was. He said I was born a giant and I'll die a giant.
Wow.
It was just really, really poignant to hear him say that stuff like that. And he got his ring. He really appreciated it, and I'm sure he's still riding the high right now.
That's pretty awesome that the organization thought to do that with all of their Hall of Famers. I mean, really, do they do anything wrong? they seem to think of everything.
Publicly, that's the case, I think.
Wow. Okay, Chris, thank you so much. We will talk to you next week.
Certainly.
Thank you for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.